As usual on a Friday, so much to talk about in this economy, so very little time. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, as I said, the 21st of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. If I could figure out how to do it, I'd let all y'all pick your own adventure on where we should start on our Friday economic retrospective. Your choices would be the Fed, China, or the debt limit and the politics of this economy. There's really no way to lose in this because we're going to talk about them all. Lynette Lopez is at Insider. Sudeep Reddy is at Politico. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai. No way to lose.
No way to lose. That's right. Well, let's see what the next, 7.5, 8 minutes bring. Sudeep, I want to start with you. We're going to start with the debt limit. I would like you to discuss for me not the nuts and bolts of Speaker McCarthy's plan, but whether you think if it passes come Wednesday or Thursday, it will get negotiations actually started, or will the White House say, no, all y'all figure this out?
We are still too far away from resolution on the debt ceiling.
It's like 4 days now. Come on.
It's good that they're moving, though. It's good because this is, you have to go through the motions. And this is really the fundamental question is when do the politics and the markets meet up on this question? Everyone's kind of hanging back. They don't think it's that big of a deal right now. We know that we're going to have to get an X date, the date when we actually don't have any more money. And that's the point that will define all of the negotiations. Tax day was this week. There's a lot of money coming into the government. Once we know how much money came in, they can determine the X date, and then this thing can actually get rolling. So it's actually good in my mind, even if we're 2 months away, at least from the X date, we're moving in the right direction to have something for negotiating.
So, Lynette, two things. Number one, I have to point out here that the entire state of California almost does not have to pay anything until October. So tax receipts from California may be a little slow, number one. Number two, what is your estimation of real peril, right? Because we all say, as we've watched these things happen in the past, oh, they're going to figure it out. That is not the vibe I have this time.
I don't know if that's the vibe, but I think the most Washington answer is I'm so glad that we're talking about this thing so we can talk about it later. It's like that is the anti-markets answer. The market's answer is this is only going in one direction, which is bad. So, okay, dilly-dally all you want to, but eventually we will get to the point where Wall Street is tired of this and starts freaking out. Whether you want to get to that point and cause pain on an economy that is extremely uncertain, That's up to Washington right now. But it is not optimistic to me that Washington has decided is starting to talk about it. It's just a clown show. And the markets understand that. And it's only going to make that eventual point come sooner when they start freaking out because they understand that there are no adults in this room.
Do you dare, Lynette, put a time frame on when the markets get sick and tired of Washington messing around?
Absolutely not, because it also depends on the condition of our financial situation, which no one really seems to understand at this point, and is only getting more confusing by the day. Because you know, we have inflation in the economy; it's still growing. It's all in our credit conditionings are tightening because of what's going on in the banking system. So there are a lot of conflicting metrics about where this is going. The last thing we need is also Washington playing a game with the full faith and credit of the United States of America. I hate to sound like Jamie Dimon or something, but that's what it is.
Yeah, it happens to be the right answer. Sudeep, let me ask you this. So Congress could fix this if they wanted to. There is, of course, the mint the coin option. We're not going to go there because the White House and the Treasury Secretary basically say they don't want to go there. My question is, and Jay Powell ducks this every time somebody asks him, what might the Fed do if things turn really bad?
So there's a whole universe of options in the federal government, the Treasury Department, and the Federal Reserve that are affectionately known as foam on the runway. What happens when you need a crash, do a crash landing and deal with what it's not going to be pleasant for anybody. There will be some pain involved. There are still a lot of risks involved, but can you insulate it? That is not a good situation to be in. Nobody should hope for that. There's a lot that can work though to make sure that the U.S. doesn't actually default on Treasury securities. But if the Fed is pulling out the last best hope for saving the country, everything else is going to be going bad. The markets are not going to be happy that the Federal Reserve has to come and save the day yet again because lawmakers couldn't get it together. But there is something there.
Yeah, Lynette, go ahead.
Am I the only one who hears foam on the runway like smoke in the water?
I don't know.
Tune of the guitar riff. I'm sorry. Yes. Please go on.
No, that's right. But look, let me ask you this. As long as we're talking about the Fed, I want to talk there. We're like 10 days out from the next meeting. Jay Powell has lots on his mind besides whatever the debt default situation might be. I had Austin Goolsbee on the program on Wednesday, I guess. I don't know. The days run together. The new president of the Chicago Fed. And he gave a speech a week or two ago in which he said, given credit conditions and given everything that's going on in banking, we should be cautious. That is his word about continuing to increase interest rates. And so I asked him about that. And I said, look, everybody in the world interpreted you saying cautious as you're a pause at the next meeting in the beginning of May. Here's his answer.
Well, I didn't say, I mean, we still got a couple of weeks before the actual meeting. So if anybody imputed some specific basis points of what I was for, that'd be inaccurate.
We all imputed that.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, so look, I don't speak for all of business and economic journalism, but we all did, right? Think that Austin Goolsbee was saying we got to pause, Sudeep?
Look, yes, okay, there's a lot of caution in the Federal Reserve right now about how far to go with this. There are a lot of mixed signals. We had the freak out just over a month ago over Silicon Valley Bank, and we thought, is this the end? Is this all falling apart? Things have stabilized in banking. It's not all falling apart there, but a credit crunch is a slow-moving phenomenon. It's going to take months to recognize it. We got a useless document from the Fed, the Beige Book, but we look at it, and there are actually really valuable insights this time that there is a slow-moving tightening of credit conditions in certain parts of the country, and they're the hints of the slowdown that could be doing the Fed's work for them. Right. So why keep whacking the economy with another interest rate hike if things are slowing down on their own? The reason why is that inflation's still pretty darn high, and you don't want to be embarrassed again by not dealing with inflation, because maybe things aren't so bad in the underlying economy and inflation could pop back up, and then you really have to hit to deal with the problem.
Lynette, go ahead.
Goolsbee said all that before the last inflation numbers came out. And don't say that about my girl, the Beige Book. That's interesting. She's interesting.
Oh, man. All right.
She's not boring.
She is not boring. It's totally interesting. I love the Beige Book. Lynette, totally
love
different topic.
Beige Book.
Totally different topic. You got 45 seconds to answer this. Secretary Yellen gave a speech the other day about China in which she said, we do not seek to decouple our economy from China. And in point of fact, she wants to go to China as soon as the time is ripe. What do you make of that?
I think that the Biden administration is constantly seeking a bottom in the relationship with China that it can just hang at instead of consistent, like, free falling. Anything aside from Yellen saying, you guys are right, China is wonderful and we've been beating up on you, is not going to make Beijing happy. But, like, hopefully they can find a place where they can stop the relationship from getting significantly worse. Yeah. And I think that's what the Biden administration is trying to do.
Fair enough. Lynette Lopez at Business Insider. Sudeep Reddy at Politico. 8 minutes on a Friday. Boom. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Guy.
On Wall Street today, you know, clearly traders have not started paying attention to the debt limit yet. Flat as flat can be. Details, numbers. Y'all know the drill. You don't have to be a trained observer of this economy to have picked up on the unease in retail. Retail sales were down in March. Layoffs at Whole Foods and Saks and Wayfair and more. Walmart, Bath & Body Works and Gap are closing stores. It is not great out there. And yet, for some chains, uncertainty is opportunity. IKEA, Barnes & Noble and Costco as well are among the companies that have announced plans to expand their retail footprint. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab takes a look at what's going on there.
Have you put off making some decisions over the last few years? Maybe stalled on making a big purchase, having kids, changing careers. You said, maybe I'll wait until the pandemic is over, until inflation cools, until this whole are we or are we not headed into a recession thing becomes clear. And did you eventually take the plunge anyways? Because really, how long are you going to put everything on hold just to time life perfectly right?
I think that's exactly the way a lot of these executives are looking at it.
Joel Rampolt is a managing director at Alex Partners.
Everything is uncertain. The range of bad outcomes that could come to pass is broad and deep, but not acting aggressively is as big a risk as acting.
Of course, acting requires some financial security, but if you're a company with some cash, there's plenty to take advantage of. Forrester retail analyst Sucharita Kadali says businesses that are closing stores create opportunities for those that want to expand.
If good real estate has come available that had not been available before, these retailers may be jumping on it.
Another reason why it might be the right time? Because some stores do well when people's wallets are tight. More shoppers have been turning to membership clubs like Costco, and someone who once shopped at Crate and Barrel may now feel more comfortable on an IKEA budget. Mark Cohen is the director of retail studies at Columbia University.
The consumer is still there, and though they may have traded down a bit, they still have disposable income and they spend it.
Plus, Cohen says it takes a couple years for stores to actually follow through on expansion plans.
There are companies who are betting that this inflationary cycle will have abated by the time they actually get to open their doors.
If a company can take on risk during shaky economic times, it's hoping it'll be primed and ready for the reward that could come during a rebound. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
So as Kristen was saying a minute ago, things in retail right now are complicated. And to the list of challenges, get ready to add student debt. 3 years ago, a little bit more, actually, the federal government paused repayment for the 45 million borrowers in this economy who owe on their student loans. And some not small percentage of people did take that pause. Some saved. Some spent, though. And retailers obviously had things those people wanted to buy. That student loan pause is going to end later this year. It will be a burden for those individual borrowers, yes, but it will also be a burden for the places they shop. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more on that one.
Before the government paused student loan payments, 38-year-old Kate Campbell had been paying about $700 a month on debt she accrued getting her MBA.
Yeah, a lot.
Back in 2017, the Federal Reserve estimated the average monthly student loan payment was $393. When Campbell could stop payments in March 2020, she did and was able to save some of that money. She also spent some. She got married in a tiny COVID wedding, bought a 100-year-old house in Baltimore. That meant other expenses.
We had to spend a lot of money on paint because the house was painted all these crazy colors, and paint is surprisingly expensive.
Campbell and her husband did the painting themselves, but still spent over a grand at Home Depot and Benjamin Moore. They also bought furniture, some used, but some new too.
I mean, nothing like super crazy, mostly Target, I would say.
There are other things she would buy, like new windows, but she's holding off because she knows debt payments are scheduled to resume, which may be true for other borrowers too, says Simon Moore, an independent financial consultant.
The more discretionary choices that people make may come under a little bit more pressure.
That'll affect all the businesses where borrowers have been choosing to spend.
Everything ranging from Tesla to your local bistro.
Constantine Yanellis is a professor of finance at the University of Chicago. He says that consumer spending will decrease, and also that when student loan payments are due again, many borrowers won't repay them at all.
I think we're going to see delinquencies and defaults spike. That's going to damage credit scores and potentially have very long-term impacts.
That could affect borrowers' ability to do things like buy a house. Once her debt payments resume, Kate Campbell says she's worried about how she'll make it all work.
It's just so much of like a mental load trying to plan your life with this always lingering in the back of your head.
On the current schedule, debt payments are likely to resume no later than the end of August. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Coming up.
But this is your last roll. This is your last chance to score.
No pressure, though. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials added 22 points today, about a 10th percent, 33,808. The NASDAQ crept up 12 points, also just about a 10th percent, 12,072. S&P 500 up just 3 points, also a 10th percent, 41,033. I think we kind of rounded up on those tenths because it was pretty flat today. For the week, the Dow fell 2-tenths percent. NASDAQ subtracted 4-tenths percent. S&P 500 down a single 10th of 1%. Kristen Schwab and Stephanie Hughes, we're talking about retailers in these times. Home Depot picked up about a 0.5% today. Target gained 1.2%. Costco ticked up 0.2%. L Brands, which owns Bath & Body Works, added 2.5%. Bond prices down. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note, 3.57%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's a speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Banks have been getting a touch more attention than usual the past month or 6 weeks or so. There was SVB and Signature. There was Fed Chair Jay Powell and Chicago Fed President Austin Goolsbee, the latter on this program, saying credit conditions are pretty much top of economic mind right now. And this week and last, there have been bank earnings. They're making piles of money, yes, but also, and interestingly, at most of the big banks, average deposits fell. It's interesting because after SVB, it was kind of taken as a given that a whole lot of people would put their cash into those bigger banks, the ones that are too big to fail. Marketplace's Justin Ho is on that one.
Up until the banking failures last month, banks have been losing deposits for about a year. Itamar Drexler, a finance professor at the Wharton School, says as the Federal Reserve raised interest rates, banks hadn't really been doing the same for depositors.
So they raised interest rates overall on their average deposit mix by a fraction of what the competitive interest rate goes up.
As a result, a lot of people said, forget it. I'll take my money and park it somewhere where I'm not earning next to nothing.
Savings deposits and checking deposits, the more liquid deposits, they flow out. That's like clockwork. And they move to other things like money market funds or other investments.
All of that stopped last month after Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank failed. Julie Hill, a professor at the University of Alabama, says people that banked with smaller institutions started worrying that their bank could be next.
Some of those depositors did, in fact, move their deposits to larger banks that were less likely to fail or were more likely to be backstopped by the government.
But in the time since, Hill says people have gotten less worried about potential bank failures. And when the Federal Reserve raised interest rates again,
people became very concerned that their deposits at banks were just not generating the yields that they could get elsewhere.
It certainly helped that the federal government stepped in and made extra money available for banks that needed it, says Stephen Bigger, director of financial services research at Argus Research.
The initial outflow and the scare that was in effect at the time has subsided. People realize that their bank is not going out of business.
But banks themselves, especially smaller banks, also realized that they needed to do something to stem the flow of deposits. Now, Bigger says,
they are paying higher for deposits. They are starting to creep those up. They're feeling the heat, so to speak, in the competition.
Bigger says that will put pressure on bank margins. But on the other hand, people might have a better reason to stash money in their savings accounts. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
We We've seen in the past couple of years more stories told by and told for Native people getting some attention in American popular culture. The success of TV shows like Reservation Dogs on FX and movies like Prey, which had the most watched premiere of any movie on Hulu, have shown that non-Native audiences are interested in these stories too and have opened doors to other creative fields. Game design, for one. Marketplace's Savannah Marr took a trip to an Indigenous pop culture festival to see how Native game developers are seizing this moment.
Indigipop X is sort of like Comic-Con, only some of the cosplayers are wearing pucker-toe moccasins, and there's a stickball tournament on the schedule. But I'm here to play games that require a little less athleticism.
Okay, so these are all 12-sided dice.
All 12-sided dice. You've got 9 white dice. And the black die, it represents the crow, sort of a mischief maker in the game.
Connor Alexander is the creator of this game, called Nasi. He's Cherokee.
Your chances of busting are getting bigger, but this is your last roll. This is your last chance to score.
Pushing my luck.
Yep.
Well, actually, I haven't had a roll.
Nasi is a nod to Hand Game and Hubbub and other traditional Indigenous games of chance. It's also a game within another of Alexander's games, called Coyote and Crow. That one's a tabletop role-playing game, or RPG. Think Dungeons and Dragons.
But instead of a Eurocentric fantasy focused on dragons and goblins, it is centered around an alternate history where colonization never occurred in the Americas.
He's had the idea for years, but finally crowdfunded it during the pandemic, when game sales were soaring.
It was an enormous success. We originally had planned on maybe generating about $25,000 for our Kickstarter, and instead it was over $1 million.
The game has generated a lot of buzz in the RPG world, and Alexander has a few more in production. He hopes its success will help chip away at a stubborn myth in the industry that mainstream audiences just won't buy in to authentically told Indigenous stories.
So when people come to me and they're like, no one will want this, my thing is, how do you know that?
Meagan Byrne makes video games like Hill Agency, which just launched in March.
Imagine a world on the brink of freedom from colonial oppression.
It is a cyber noir, Indigenous mystery interactive novel.
Set in a post-apocalyptic future where its Native characters aren't defined by their relationship to colonialism or genocide.
The Sleuth of Agamaski. Avoiding the past became second nature, dedicating her days to the faceless, rejected citizens of Agamaski.
But the game deals with a very contemporary issue, violence against Native women. Byrne hopes the sci-fi setting and the tone of the game help Native players grapple with that very heavy theme from a comfortable distance.
So we go cheesy. We're like, the dialogue is cheese. The music, as beautiful as it is, also like really lays into that kind of noir aesthetic.
The game needs to sell 40,000 units for Byrne's indie studio to break even. But where others in the industry might see a major marketing challenge, Byrne sees opportunity.
This is a grossly underserved market that deserves to have content for them.
The crowd at Indigipop X is evidence of that. People have traveled thousands of miles just to be in a place where their indigeneity and their love of nerdy pop culture aren't at odds.
It's just refreshing, and knowing that we're finally being seen and heard.
Tamia Wright is Snoqualmie. She's here all the way from Washington State, mostly for the comic books. But what she's seen here today has her interested in gaming, sort of for the first time.
About time. About darn time. So actually, I might consider picking up one of the RPG or tabletop games and give it a go.
Now that she's found some that imagine a hopeful future for Native people. In Oklahoma City, I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which I kind of love, but in which also Europe kind of needs to get a grip. So you know how Miller High Life bills itself as the champagne of beers. They put it on the cans and the bottles and everything. Well, it seems a shipment of Miller High Life was on its way to Germany through Belgium when Belgium's customs workers at the port of Antwerp decided that that whole champagne of beers thing violated French rules that say only wines made using a very particular process within a very particular region can be called champagne. Right about here, you know where this is going, right? According to the French Champagne Lobbying Organization and Belgian customs officials, 2,352 cans of Miller High Life were destroyed earlier this week. All right, we're going. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. More layoffs to add to the count. The Wall Street Journal reports Lyft is going to cut 1,200 jobs. That's about 30% of its entire workforce. To be clear, that's not Lyft drivers, by the way, but actual Lyft employees. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Donna Tam is the executive editor. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. We will see you on Monday, all right? This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.